The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, here with News Dissector Radio on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. And News Dissector Radio is based on the blog that appears every day at NewsDissector.com/blog, MediaChannel.org. And hopefully, this is an extension of the blog, but also, in a way, getting deeper into some of the issues that we raise and discuss. Joining me today, in a few more minutes, will be Harvey Wasserman, one of the leading anti-nuclear activists, advocates, writers, thinkers, and speakers in the country. Talk about events in Japan. We also hope to have Arjun Makijani, a expert on energy and environmental research, who's supposed to be joining us as well. We have been having some problems getting him. We're competing with MSNBC, but he's promised to come on. And in the second half hour, Richard Bell and Rory O'Connor will be talking about nuke speak, the way these nuclear issues are presented to us by our media. So that's our program for today. We want to start off with a reminder that March 19th, of course, is the anniversary of the war in Iraq, something that has sort of slipped out of the news, slipped out of many of our consciousnesses, but remains very much present for the people who live in Iraq and has defined this whole era in ways that few other events have. And to start our program to commemorate the war, the song by Polar Levine, myself, Media Wars.
We're going to fix that technical problem.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News.
Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Media war.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis.
48 hours to war, dun, 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 showdown to Saddam.
And the purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary, I'll follow up on Jimmy's question a little bit. And I thought I answered that.
Media war.
Well, media war, that's what's going on. It's still going on in our world, whether or not there are armed conflicts. Of course, the latest one is in Libya, and perhaps we'll have some commentary on that today as well. We've moved on the nuclear issue from Hiroshima to Fukushima. The terrible and horrible, heartbreaking events in Japan present a strange concatenation of disasters. I've got that word a little bit wrong here. Concatenation. I'm reading now from Jonathan Schell in the Nation. First, the planet unleashed one of its primordial shocks, an earthquake of a magnitude greater than any previously recorded in Japan. That earthquake, in turn, created the colossal tsunami, which, when it struck the country's northeastern shores, pulverized everything in its form. And part of what it seems to have affected dramatically are the nuclear power plants in that region and through Japan. So joining me today to discuss this as someone who certainly I respect, who's been involved on this nuclear issue for more years than either one of us want to remember, Harvey Wasserman. Harvey helped create Musicians United for Safe Energy back in the late 70s. He was principal activist in the anti-nuke movement that helped stop the spread of nuclear power plants in parts of this country. And now he's commenting on and monitoring the situation in Japan. A recent article notes that Japan's quake could have irradiated the entire United States. Harvey Wasserman wrote that on March 11th on nukefree.org, and he's here to share his views on all of this. Harvey, can you bring us up to date with the status of the nuclear disaster in Japan?
Well, it's touch and go, Danny. We got this for the first time in history. We have not one, not two, not three, but four, and maybe five or six reactors simultaneously melting down. It's almost incomprehensible. I don't believe the Japanese have sufficient staff to even begin to deal with this. And they're pouring in water as best they possibly can. I guess they're running a power line in. Isn't that perfect? The engineering geniuses have to run a power line into their nuclear power plant to save it. There's spent fuel burning. There's radioactive cores burning. These poor workers, I just cannot tell you how awful it is. Every one of these guys is going to die. A lot of these journalists are going to die, by the way. I don't know if you remember, Danny, you probably do, that after Three Mile Island, Paul Cowan wrote a piece for the Village Voice tracking the health of the journalists who went into TMI to cover the story, and they dropped like flies, and I think the journalists are at Fukushima are going to also. The cloud from Fukushima has apparently reached Los Angeles today and will carry across the United States. If this 9.0 earthquake had hit California, it probably would have ripped apart four American reactors, two at Diablo Canyon at San Luis Obispo and two at San Onofre, which is between L.A. and San Diego. I've been to both of them. In fact, I was arrested at Diablo Canyon in 1984, but the San Onofre plant is literally right on the ocean. It's not 100 yards from the shore. And had there been a major earthquake, which could actually happen, it could actually be happening as we speak. Both these plants, with all four reactors, are very close to powerful active earthquake faults. And if there was such a shock there, these plants would be torn apart.
Now, two points, Harvey, if I could. Remember Chernobyl, of course, the so-called jumpers, the workers there who jumped into the reactor to try to seal it, and yeah. all of them died very quickly.
Well, there's
afterwards.
You're right about that. We call them jumpers in the United States. Over there, they called them liquidators in traditional Soviet form. And the number was 800,000. When I first read that, I thought it was a typographical error, but there were actually 800,000 Soviet draftees who were sent through the Chernobyl plant to clean it up. And this is well after the accident. And those guys, I actually spoke in Russia in 1996 on the 10th anniversary of the accident. I talked to a lot of these guys. They really reminded me of the Vietnam vets against the war. They were, powerful, strong, committed people who were absolutely furious about what had been done to them, and they were dying in droves. And, Fukushima, one of the problems is that the radiation, because there are four reactors seriously stressed, there's so much radiation there that, the workers are just doomed. But it's more than that. In some cases, it's too radioactive to go in there and live more than 5 or 10 minutes.
Just want to mention one thing here. My voice is crackling a little. I don't know why. Maybe it's just the excitement of being on the air with you, Harvey, after all these years, doing it again, as we have so many times in the past, talking about this issue. But I want to just introduce Sherry Welch, the dissectress in Atlanta, who's joining us today, as well as participating in the program as she does every week, our program producer. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Danny. Hello, Harvey. No,
Nick
Wasserman. I can't
Thank
wait
you.
To hear you
Thank
talk
you.
About Solartopia.
Okay, I hope we get there.
Well, let's keep going on this for a moment first, because we have to establish certain facts. One of the things that the American media seems to have discovered for the first time last night as I was watching the network news was Indian Point, saying that's
right.
The most dangerous, the most exposed, the closest to a massive population center. Of course, this has been said repeatedly by people who have been trying to close Indian Point for decades, and
right.
yet it somehow continues, and now we have the Governor Cuomo of New York saying, yes, we must deal with this immediately, et cetera.
Well, about
so
time. It's about time we have a governor of New York who's talked about shutting this thing.
Well, I think
Danny, as you know, the first airplane that flew into the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, flew right over Indian Point. and had they chosen to hit it as on that day, we wouldn't be talking about 3,000 people dead and a couple billion dollars worth of damage. We'd be talking about maybe 300,000, maybe 3 million. I mean, you know, the Indian Point is just an utter catastrophe, and it is the same design as Fukushima.
So we have this incredible disaster. Now, were there warnings about the Fukushima plant in advance? I know that WikiLeaks, in one of its cables, warned of problems there. This has been reported. There were General Electric engineers who questioned the model of the plant, the design that was being used here in this country and eventually at Fukushima, and opposed it. But nothing was done.
Right. A lot of people have questioned that design. I mean, I have to tell you, every once in a while there's a humorous moment. John King on CNN, I've been following it on CNN. I have to say, I found their coverage to be pretty good. So John King was being explained the basic design of the GE reactor, which has the spent fuel up in the air above the radioactive core. I mean, it's astounding, and it's not in the containment, but it's up there, way up high in the air.
On the fourth floor, yeah.
Yeah, and John King just looked incredulous, and his response was, well, this is a bathtub on the roof. And that's what it is. It's a bathtub on the roof. There are 23 reactors like this in the United States.
They're saying that the problem is as much from the spent rods, so-called, that are not that spent, as from the uranium in the reactors themselves, that there's a continuing radiation danger there. Now, it seems as if the Japanese have been sort of, in a way, minimizing it. Now, suddenly, the United States government is saying that it's much more serious than the Japanese have said, the same United States government that supported nuclear reactors in this country.
What's happened, Danny, is there's actually a guy at the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, JASCO, who is taking these things seriously. It's not the government so much, it's him. I mean, the Obama administration has been miserable on this. Their performance has been abominable. I mean, he's come out in the middle of all this, Obama has, and said, well, we're going to continue with nuclear power. He has a deep root in the Commonwealth Edison and Exelon in Chicago. He's been with the nuclear industry all along. And he has been very unforthcoming in warning the American public about the radiation cloud that has arrived in Los Angeles, or will today. And, people have no idea what to do. The idea of discounting it as being somehow a not significant health impact is simply wrong. And what you're going to do, unfortunately, everybody knows about, well, many people know about potassium iodide, which protects the thyroid, but it's, if there are problems with potassium iodide, you have to be careful, you can't take it. People with heart conditions have to be careful, and the government should be informing the public. Furthermore, you can't get it now because, there's been such a rush. What potassium iodide does is it protects the thyroid. If you ingest radioactive iodine into your thyroid, it will emit electrons and will harm your thyroid. So what you want to do is get good iodine to put into your thyroid before the bad stuff comes, and then it won't take up the bad stuff. Simple enough. And this has been known for a long, long time. In fact, they distributed potassium iodide too late, of course, at Three Mile Island. But, people are now concerned about this, as they should be. The radiation is coming to L.A., and worse will come to L.A. and then across the United States, because the winds do blow, as we've learned, from west to east. And, this is something that this is a responsibility of the government to inform the public and to make this stuff, either make it available or explain the ramifications. And Obama has done none of that because it will reflect badly on the nuclear industry. And he's still trying to get $36 billion in new loan guarantees.
Explain this to us a little bit more. Echelon is a company out of Chicago, correct? And that's a big booster and very much in the nuclear power business, right?
It was also the biggest, actually, yeah.
One of his financial supporters in the race for president, correct?
Yes. They built his career. They picked him up as a state senator. They put him in the state senate, as a matter of fact. And they have supported him all along as a young candidate. It's been a nightmare with him.
I think that's one of the reasons, people who didn't know this were kind of surprised when Obama kept referencing the importance of nuclear power as part of a balanced program for energy sustainability in the future.
He's been awful on this. He's been as bad as Bush would have been.
Can I just say one thing? Wasn't excellent part of Dick Cheney's secret energy meetings in March of 2001 part of
Future Gen? Oh, absolutely. Yes, and on top of that, one of Obama's chief advisors now is Jeffrey Immelt, the head of General Electric, which built these reactors. Now, the General Electric nuclear division is now owned by Hitachi, and, you know, as Westinghouse is owned by Mitsubishi, the nuclear division. So, you know, these guys are totally in the, you know, in bed with the industry. They're responsible here. There's also been this attempt, you know, over the past years since Chernobyl, all these guys, you know, I debate these guys and they say, well, that was the Soviets. They didn't really know what they were doing. It was inferior technology. Well, the Japanese are better than the Americans at nuclear power. They've been at it in a different way. They understand the technology. As I say, they own General Electric and Westinghouse, which built virtually all the reactors in the United States. All the French reactors are Westinghouse designed. And, you know, there's no hiding here. Now, when I was in Japan in the mid-70s, we this is not a surprise here. We talked very clearly about what would happen to a nuclear facility if it was hit by an earthquake and a tsunami. And these guys said, oh, no, 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 it's not a problem. We've got it under control. We can handle it. Well, there are 55 reactors in Japan, and they are all susceptible to exactly what's going on at Fukushima. You know, there's 10 reactors at Fukushima. In 2007, less than 5 years ago, 7 reactors were hit in a similar situation at Kashiwazaki. I spoke there in the 1970s, and they had to shut 7 reactors. Thankfully, there wasn't a tsunami, but, you know, it was a very dangerous situation, and they just kind of proceeded along happily operating the rest of these plants.
So this situation, also what's the connection between the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which is the company that's the operating company here, that has not been divulging a lot of information, doesn't seem prepared to, and American reactors? I'm told that there's a connection that this company is also involved in the new reactors to be built in America, or the ones they want to build.
Well, Greg Palast has done a great piece. I posted it at nukefree.org. By the way, if you're interested in following this, Danny, and all your listeners, go to nukefree.org, and we're keeping right on top of it. And, you know, I'll post this interview if you want when we're done. And the Greg Palast piece points out that the Japanese are in line to fund a very large nuclear project in Texas, in South Texas. Now, whether they're going to continue to do this after this catastrophe, I don't know. I hope we don't have to fight that one. But the Japanese and the American industries are joined at the hip. It's all based on General Electric and Westinghouse, and that is now Hitachi and Mitsubishi. So, you know, the link here is inextricable, and these guys are just totally corrupt. I will say one thing in defense of the TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company. You know, the media guys are yelling at them for not being forthcoming, and as if that's an issue, as if the American reactor industry was any more forthcoming at TMI, for example, which they were not. And they lied outright about everything at Three Mile Island. So there's really no difference here. The one thing, one common thread that all nuclear power companies has is that they lie, you know, both about what's going on and about the health impacts.
They minimize the dangers, right?
Oh, absolutely. TEPCO, they may not know what's going on. That's what's really terrifying. If they knew what was going on online, that'd be one thing. And they probably are, but, you know, as to what they do know. But what the reality is they don't know what's going on. You got 4 world-class catastrophes going on simultaneously with 2 more waiting in the wings. I mean, they have no idea what they're doing. And so I would actually be somewhat reassured if I was certain that they were lying.
Well, now you see, for example, in Germany and many other countries shutting down their nuclear plants, they're reviewing them. Now everybody's talking about we have to reappraise safety and all this. It's not as if there haven't been people talking about these safety problems for years. No, true?
Decades. Danny, you and I did this in 1976 when you were in Boston. And you were the news dissector then, and I was No Nukes then, and here we are again 40 years later. What is it? It's 45 years. And, you know, these guys are still doing the same stuff. And now we have stopped them, in a very meaningful way. Those demonstrations at Seabrook, in that period of time, Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 nuclear plants in the U.S., and we've kept it to 104. But so many of those are on earthquake faults, and so many of those are Fukushima-style designs that, you know, we're still in deep, radioactive waste here. This is an apocalyptic situation.
There are also other connections being made, Harvey. I don't know if you saw the New York Times today, but Floyd Norris is writing on the business section front page. 4 years ago, there were fears of a financial meltdown, a term borrowed from the nuclear power industry. Now there are fears of a real meltdown. Comparing the two events may risk seeming insensitive to the rising human toll in Japan, but there are similarities in causation. In each case, overconfidence born of experience led to increased risks once a disaster unfolded. And on the Naked Capitalism site today, there was a criticism of Norris for saying, well, the bank meltdowns don't really have any impact on human lives, where the nuclear ones do. And, you know, Eve Smith, the editor of the site, said, nonsense. Look at all the people who have lost their homes, lost their jobs. Basically, their lives are a wreck as a result of the irresponsibility of the banks, which is an issue I've been pursuing and following. But the banks
I think over the years, Danny, we've learned there are two basic things behind the nuclear power industry: arrogance and greed. And, they should call these arrogance unit one and hubris unit two and greed unit three. I mean, that's all it's about.
So now, as you watch today, watch the news reporting on this, the sort of incredulous, you know, oh my God, you know, there's this nuclear meltdown underway in Japan. How stupid of them. What goes through your mind? I mean, after this whole lifetime of talking about this issue.
You know what? I hate to say it. You know, there was Three Mile Island, and then there was Chernobyl. Now there's Fukushima. If we don't shut them down after this, there'll be something worse. I mean, we are being sent a message here. And, you know, it was 35 years since, we talked, not 45, but that's enough. I don't want to have to be talking with you again in another 10 years. And then we're talking about, you know, something even worse than Fukushima. I mean, you know, Chernobyl was horrifying. Fukushima, we don't know how bad this is going to be. But, you know, you and I both have daughters, and we want to see healthy grandchildren. This is not some kind of
And my daughter lives in L.A., where the cloud is now descending. Obviously, we're all connected to this issue in one way or another, and we have to kind of understand that. I mean,
I 100% agree.
And I think Sherry also, you know, just from your point of view, you know, Sherry, to see the incredible way in which the initial reaction was sort of denial, and now the United States government, or at least one guy in the United States government, is actually trying to talk some truth about all of this, and this is creating all this friction between Japan and America. They call it the Gaijin effect, where, you know, the Americans sort of start speaking out as if they're all-knowing, when in fact we have so many of the same problems here.
Yeah.
Well, having lived in L.A., my heart goes out to all those people, everybody right now. It just needs to be gone. This lives for 300,000 years. Plus, I lived in Las Vegas for 5 years, where they want to bring all of the waste to Yucca Mountain that sits on an earthquake default line.
Well, I've actually been in Yucca Mountain. I've seen that earthquake fault. You know, you got to hand it to them. They found a, it's a dormant volcano, by the way, and they actually found a place where you can actually see the earthquake, the earthquake line going right through the thing. So, but you know, let's enough talk about L.A. It will be in New York in 3 or 4 days. I mean, it will go across the country.
I'm in Atlanta. Are we okay?
No, you're not okay. The problem is you're on planet Earth. That's the problem. This stuff goes everywhere.
You know,
the Chernobyl cloud came to California in 10 days, but it was in New England in 2 weeks.
Jonathan Schell has written a tremendous amount about these issues. You know, concludes his article in The Nation. He says, the problem is not that another backup generator is needed, or that the safety rules aren't tight enough, or that the pit for the nuclear waste is in the wrong geological location, or that controls on proliferation are lax. It is that a stumbling, imperfect, probably imperfectible creature like ourselves is unfit to wield the stellar fire released by the split or fused atom. When nature strikes, why should humankind compound the trouble? The earth is provided with enough primordial forces of destruction without our help in introducing more. I mean, you know, this is a sort of larger prophetic issue. This was raised, of course, in Japan after Hiroshima, saying we're looking at the future of humanity here, or the lack of a future for humanity, that this is a signal, is a warning to the world, was the words that we used, I believe. And now we're getting another one. And it seems like the world is as ill-prepared now as it was then to see the implications of this.
Well, Jonathan Schell is very eloquent. His book on nuclear weapons was right, and I'm glad he's carried this over now to nuclear power plants. One of the great geniuses who built these reactors said, oh, let's take nuclear weapons material and turn it into nuclear fuel. And, of course, it's really expensive
Atoms
to do that.
Atoms for peace.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense at all economically, but they wanted to do it for a PR stunt. And we said, hey, you know, you're going to introduce plutonium, the deadliest substance known to man, known to humankind, into the fuel chain. And if there's an accident, the plutonium is going to go right out. And they said, oh, no, not a problem. And that's what's in Unit 3, which is now pouring into the atmosphere. So these people, you know, have to be brought under control. And this, and Jonathan Schell is right. This technology is absolutely unusable.
I mean, when I was in Hiroshima some years ago, and, you know, just...
Danny, I'm going to have to run, brother.
Oh, okay. Well, listen, Harvey Wasserman.
So I'm really honored, and I hope we can do this again.
Harvey Wasserman, thank you for joining us. I know you're in great demand. Give us that website again.
Nukeferee.org.
Okay.
And solartopia.org.
All right, well,
we'll
get
so
to Solartopia another time.
Time.
Okay, Harvey Wasserman, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back in a few minutes with Rory O'Connor and Dick Bell to talk about Nuke Speak. So stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number to call if you want to, 1-888-874-4888. Stay with us.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a
40% of the stations carry no news of the world.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by Coke, by Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say. We don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. So do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit. Slim slam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news good.
What we need to know.
News good.
What we want to know.
News good.
What we think we know.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Steve Lindman. I host the Progressive Radio News Hour. It's an in-depth truth hour, an antidote to government and corporate managed news and infotainment on the most important world and national issues affecting everyone. Distinguished guests are featured regularly to provide cutting-edge commentary and analysis not available from the dominant media, offering biased, irresponsible misinformation on what everyone needs to know. The Progressive Radio News Hour is Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, as well as Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Progressive Radio Network, of course. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
everyone. This is Richard Martin, host of your bi-weekly wake-up call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, coming to you live all the way from Singapore. I try to cut through the lies and misinformation to bring you what you need to know to prepare for the economic horrors that lie ahead. I'll give it to you straight in simple language. I don't sugarcoat the news. Unlike the government and media, I have no agenda other than to make you aware of ways in which you can protect yourselves and your loved ones. That's the Wake Up Call, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. here on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, Progressive Radio fans. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and I do a program here on the network called The Green Front, as in reporting from the green front lines. That's where I've been for more than a decade, covering a beat that I think is fun, fascinating, fact-filled, and sometimes even kind of funny. Or not, when you consider the implications of our world-class denial here in America. The Green Front is an ostrich-free zone, though, where I select the most interesting and passionate eco-innovators out there and bring them to you live each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. So join me as we wake up America with the activists, authors, experts, and ordinary citizens out there making an extraordinary green difference.
Progressive Radio Network is celebrating 5 years of independent news.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
Back here now, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector on News Dissector Radio. We're talking about Japan. We're talking about nuclear power. We're talking about what's not being talked about in the coverage of many of these issues. Early on, back in the 70s, I believe, late, early 80s, Rory O'Connor and Richard Bell wrote a book called Nuke Speak to look at how these nuclear issues are covered and how they're miscovered or not covered properly. And, you know, the book has been around for a long time, but suddenly it's come back into relevance, if you will, because of what happened in Fukushima, what's happening right now in our world, a tremendous alarm and concern about nuclear power. And, of course, one of the concerns is, are we being well informed about what's happening there or what's happening here? So, Dick Bell, welcome. Rory O'Connor, welcome. What are your thoughts about Fukushima and the way it's being covered?
Well, Danny, this is Rory. I want to thank you for having us on today. And, you know, the main point that we have to make is that these kind of euphoric visions and the euphemistic language that we've been seeing for decades out of the nuclear developers are something that is intrinsic to nuclear development. It's actually their own language that they speak, a language that we call nuke speak, obviously after George Orwell and his Newspeak language in 1984. And what Newspeak does is basically set the stage for public relations. It's all about the selling of nuclear development to the world.
Dick Bell?
Hi, Danny. It's Richard Bell.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I think we're seeing almost a textbook case of how Newspeak plays itself out in a disaster. Everything is heightened in a disaster. But just to take one example of one way of keeping people from understanding what's going on is to not gather the information in the first place. So even after Three Mile Island, even after Chernobyl, we're discerning that the authorities can't tell us how much radiation is being released from these reactors. They don't know what's going on inside them. And the reason is they never bothered to put the monitoring in. They didn't bother to put in the little gauges and things. which wouldn't have cost them very much money. And instead, we have these, you know, this ridiculous ceremony of helicopters flying over the molten reactors, trying to figure out what's going on. So, one of the phrases that we said people use is your basic nothing can go wrong, that the engineers have thought of everything. And here we have the engineers siting these reactors in a high seismic zone next to an ocean, and nobody thinks, well, what happens if there's a tsunami? So that's an example of what we term the nuclear mindset, that you become unable, if you're using this language, you become unable even to see the kinds of problems that pop up in the real world.
Well, you know, this sales campaign, Jonathan Schell talks about that in The Nation, too. He reminds us that in the 50s, Walt Disney made a cartoon, Our Friend the Atom. And the Eisenhower administration in that period came up with an Atoms for Peace proposal, 1953, which required nuclear-armed nations to sell nuclear power technology to other nations in exchange for following certain non-proliferation rules. This bargain is now enshrined in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which promotes nuclear power even as it discourages nuclear weapons. And, you know, the whole idea was to basically salvage the reputation of people who were being pictured as nuclear hawks, to show that they were really trying to do something positive and something good. Take the weapon out of the hands of the soldiers and put it into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adopt it to the arts of peace. And that was that proposal way back then. That was the beginnings of the selling of nuclear power. And it's an issue that goes on to this day. I was visiting Iran in November. You know, there's the whole issue of nuclear proliferation. And Iran's fallback position is, well, really, all we want to do is build nuclear power plants. And
right.
As opposed to having nuclear weapons. And, you know, Iran's supporters have said, oh, good. You see, they're not really out to create weapons. And I raised this issue at a film festival that I was a judge at, you know, challenging this view that nuclear power plants, you know, were a panacea for energy needs and weren't dangerous. And I tell you, I got a totally negative reaction from most of the people in the room who felt like, look, you don't want us to have these plants because you want to retard our development. You want to keep Iran poor and you want to keep us dependent on you, and as opposed to giving us the same tools that other countries have. And it was a pretty fierce debate there, and I must say I was on the losing side of it, even though I raised it, and people later said you were brave to do so. Yeah.
Gentlemen, speaking of the losing side, this is just breaking. They are now admitting that the radiation leak is serious enough to kill people, and they're going to have to bury it under concrete, as happened at Chernobyl.
That's what happened at Chernobyl. Well,
yeah,
they're
admitting. That's what they're saying is that they're going to rebuild from scratch.
They're admitting now what has been obvious for quite some time, and that speaks to the point that Dick was making. You know, you see this nuke speak, this nuclear language, and initially, as I said earlier, it evolved as a language by the nuclear industry in an attempt to influence the public consideration of nuclear issues. But the ultimate irony here is that it actually works as a linguistic filter, if you will. That is to say, it encodes the very beliefs and assumptions that the nuclear developers are going into, so that it literally becomes impossible for them to even imagine that something like this could happen. It's not part of the nuclear mindset. They don't have the language to even conceive of what is happening now with Fukushima, what happened at Chernobyl, or what happened at Three Mile Island.
But this was exactly what in 1984, Orwell's novel, one of the things that the hero...
Yeah, it wasn't written, by the way, in 1984, or was it?
It was written in 1948, and
reversed
the two numbers.
Yeah. 1948. But one of the things that they were working on was reducing the number of words in the language so that it would become physically, it would just become psychically impossible to think of, say, freedom as a word. And you see that kind of thing going on here. just to pick up on Danny's point, I would argue that the phrase "atoms for peace" that Eisenhower launched has been one of the most destructive pieces of propaganda in the history of peace, because it did provide a perfect cover for these nuclear weapons programs. You know, atoms for peace, atoms for war. The atoms don't know the difference. They don't. They're going to do their little atomic thing, regardless of what they're in. And when you build a nuclear power plant, when you have that industry in your country, you've got the raw materials to work with to start out with. You've got your engineers all trained about in the nuclear physics. And the physics are the same, whether they're for a reactor or a bomb. Now, the reactors are not supposed to blow up, and the bombs are equally exquisitely engineered to blow up. But, you know, in fact, the reactors, as we're seeing in Japan, are quite capable of at least not nuclear weapon-style detonation, but they're capable of producing chemical explosions and then releasing all this radioactivity.
You know, and as Harvey Wasserman just pointed out, they also have plutonium in some of these now, which, of course, is the fuel for the nuclear bomb. So, but let me just take a moment here while we're on the subject of atoms for peace. I want to read you something that comes from a book written by the first chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission in the United States, David Lilienthal. He wrote a book in 1963 about atoms for peace called Change, Hope, and the Bomb. And what Lilienthal had to say here is that as a result of America having actually used nuclear weapons, having dropped them twice on Japan, as we know, he said that the discovery that we had produced so terrible a weapon meant that we simply had to have an important peaceful use for it, because we are a peace-loving people. Therefore, says the chairman, the first chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, he says, we were grimly determined to prove that this discovery was not just a weapon. This led, perhaps, to wishful thinking, a wishful elevation of the sunny side of the atom.
Right.
Well, there you go.
I mean, you see this come up, just to take a particular word, you've been hearing about the spent fuel in the pools around the nuclear plant. And, you know, the word spent implies it's over, we're done with it. But in fact, as we're now seeing, these fuel rods are still highly radioactive. They're generating heat. And if you don't keep them covered with water all the time, they're capable of heating up to the point of burning and melting.
You know, I did see one example of a sort of contrarian being interviewed on television. I don't think they really knew who this guy was or what he was thinking, but they were trying to reassure everybody that they're pumping water from the sea into the plant. You know, as a measure to try to cool the rods, you know, and there was a lot of reporting on this. And this guy was being interviewed, I think it was MSNBC, and he said, what? I've never heard of that before. That's ridiculous. There's no way that that's going to cool down this plant. It's a complete, a disaster. That's desperate, and it's not going to work. And lo and behold, it hasn't worked. But, you know, there's been very little critical analysis. It's beginning now, but a little bit late.
When the audience, you know, the mass media has pretty much totally swallowed this myth that we were in the middle of having a nuclear renaissance. And there's a nuke speak. There's a nuke speak term for you being created, you know, within the last 10 years. Because they're claiming, well, these don't burn fuel, so therefore, they're green, you know, they're part of the green energy economy. We've seen President Obama, who has been unfortunately a strong supporter of nuclear power, change what the federal government was doing to get off of fossil fuels from establishing a renewable energy standard, which would only have included things like solar power and stuff, to a clean energy standard, which he includes nuclear power as a clean
this
energy.
This sounds like his, you know, praising the oil, drilling, deep,
right.
the deep
but,
ocean drilling
you know,
in the Gulf until it blew up in his face.
We have a wonderful language, you know, English. It's a great language. And we have these poor little words like clean. You know, it's a great old, simple English word.
Okay.
And to call nuclear power clean is such, you know, it's so misleading. And yet millions and millions of dollars have been spent on advertising by the Nuclear Energy Institute and the other organs that support nuclear power.
Sherry, we have a caller from Georgia joining us now.
That would be Robert Farquhar, probably.
Bob, is that you? Are you there?
Yes, this is Bob in Bonaire, Georgia. How are y'all?
Okay, I'm all good. And please speak.
Well, you know, listening to y'all talk about this, I'm originally from Chicago, but I've adopted y'all down here. But listening to the discussions about Atoms for Peace and Project Plowshares, which that's tied in with, the idea of using nuclear explosives to create harbors instantaneously, channels to improve our lives. We went through a period of that under the direction of Edward Teller, who never saw a thermonuclear bomb he didn't like. And
I think love is the operative term.
Okay. Well, that's true. But I'm working on a book here on the subject, and as part of Plowshares, I mean, we used nuclear weapons to stimulate gas production, and it worked.
Right.
It produced more gas. The only problem was the gas was radioactive. We couldn't use it.
It's easy to be amused now by this, but you know, this is deadly serious, and the emphasis
is
on deadly. You know, I mean, this is extremely worrying, and the fact is that the panic reaction in a good part of the world, I mean, 50,000 people came out and protested in Germany. You know, nobody's
right.
protested here in America, but you know, this situation here is as serious.
It is, but and the people here, a lot of their concern is, where can I get potassium iodine pills, thinking that it's going to protect them from radiation, and it won't.
Right.
I spend a lot of time trying to educate people about the realities of nuclear, whether it be power or weapons, and it's amazing how much people don't know, and I think that's been part of the problem through the years with people not being against these things.
What we're saying, our point is, there's a reason that people don't know things, and that's because they're being lied to. They're being told things in a language that relies at best on euphemism. You know, Dick and I wrote a blog post a couple of days ago on this topic, and one of the things we pointed out was that the Nuclear Regulatory's own glossary of atomic-related words and phrases literally has no word for meltdown. The word meltdown does not exist for the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Well, it's you could take the nuclear weapons industry. They no longer refer to warheads as warheads. They call
them
physics packages.
Well, let's not forget that when India first exploded a nuclear bomb, they called it a peaceful nuclear device.
Yes, a PNE, peaceful nuclear explosion. We called them that, too, and we were doing it back in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s before we stopped the Plowshares program.
Well,
people may remember the movie China Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And the China Syndrome idea was, it's actually a euphemism for a meltdown, that the, it's sort of a U.S. racist metaphor, but the idea being that if the fuel melted and melted through the bottom of the containment vessel, which is still a possibility in Japan, that the fuel would keep melting on through the earth until it popped out on the other side in China. Now, you know,
China is very alarmed about all of this. You'll notice.
Right. Now, in Japan, it may be the U.S. syndrome now, because I'm not sure what's exactly under Japan on the other side of the planet. But the Chinese should be very alarmed, because there's a possibility of release of a large amount of highly radioactive airborne materials.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it's utterly up to which way the wind is blowing, whether
Right, that's correct. And Russia has concerns as well about the drift of this material.
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing is a freaked out world, you know, but suddenly we're trying to deal with all kinds of other issues at the same time. Financial crisis, the situation in Libya, the, you know, dramatic developments in the Middle East, you know, two wars, and one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. It seems as if we're in a situation where, you know, our whole world can't handle or process all of these things happening at the same time. They certainly can't process this very well because we're not getting the quality of information we deserve.
Which is true. And my question to many people over the last week or so has been, what did you care about this before now? And my point being that, you know, people aren't involved in it until something does happen, and then until the next news cycle comes around with something new.
Well, let me just ask, thank you for joining us. I'm going to have to just go to Richard Bell and Rory O'Connor right now. Just to sum up for us, we only have 2 minutes left, how you see what we can learn from this, or what the questions we should be asking. True enough, there's been a tremendous distortion. The language itself has been actually invoked to keep us from understanding what's going on. What lessons have you drawn from this study that you've made of nuke speak?
Well, the first lesson I would say is would be to echo your caller, which is that people have got to get involved. Look, none of this stuff is new. In 1946, 65 years ago, Albert Einstein warned us of this. He said that our world faces a crisis unperceived. Before this, he said the unleashed power of the atom has changed everything except our modes of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. There have been warnings. There have been many people like Harvey Wasserman, you had on the program earlier, Dick and I, who've been writing about this literally for decades. So the first thing is just for people to educate themselves, not rely on the government or the industry for information. And once they do educate themselves, they have to be moved to action.
Well, thank you, Rory O'Connor.
Let me just say the other thing I would say is that we see how horrible what's going on in Japan is. And what we're not paying attention to equally is that the world, the U.S. and the Soviet Union in particular, or the Russia now, still have thousands of nuclear weapons ready to launch on a few minutes' notice, any one of which would dwarf what's going on in Japan right now.
Okay, Richard Bell, we have to call it now. We have to call it now for time. But I hear you, and I think anybody who's listening can hear the intensity and the passion of your concerns and the call to action that we all hear. I have to wrap up the show now. If you want to reach me, you can write to dissector@mediachannel.org. I was hoping to talk about my recent visit to the Al Jazeera Forum, but I never got to it. But my report appears not only on a media channel and other sites, but also on the Al Jazeera website, aljazeera.net, for my experiences there. You can certainly listen to this program as a podcast. It's going to be up on the Progressive News... PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We'll have the actual podcast, and we'll have it up on our blog as soon as we get access to it. So thank you for listening again. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you, Rory. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Harvey Wasserman. Thank you to all of those of you who have been listening in, and I hope that you appreciate the effort here to try to bring issues to you in a way that get a little deeper than they do in the news. Thank you.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops.